evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Elise Vernon Perlstein. She had a 17-year career in wildlife biology, and now she's in a second career as a natural perfumer, consultant, and educator on the biology, artistry, and history of perfume ingredients. And we're talking about her new book. It is it's got a lot of wild information in here. Scent, a natural history of fragrance. Elise, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Before we start, I want to talk about your descriptive terms when you were talking about scents in the book. It really reminded me of the way wine connoisseurs talk. Did you have to develop a vernacular for talking about scents and fragrances?
I really did. There's kind of a list out there, you know, woody, rosy, floral, sharp. I'm drawing a blank, but there are a lot of words out there that to me didn't quite get there.
Okay.
And so a lot of my career has been smelling things and trying to figure out how to talk about them. And sometimes it's sort of synesthesia, where
yep.
you see color yep. and smell and feelings all blended together.
Sure.
And I remember I did a little class with some children, and I had peppermint and I had orange. And I asked them to describe it, and one little boy said, well, the peppermint's sharp, and the orange is soft.
Hmm.
And I think children have, you know, a real perception, and I guess my point is sometimes you have to use a feeling or an experience or something else to describe a fragrance, because there just aren't that many words.
I was going to say, and also for our senses, I think the sense of smell is the least understood of our five senses.
It is, and it's been somewhat ignored. Somewhere in the past 200 or 300 years, vision became our predominant
yeah.
sense, and it's the one that's kind of written about and studied and spoken about. And I would like to think there's a little renaissance of the sense of smell and aroma as people begin to appreciate perfumes and aromatherapy and fragrance, and coming back to, for example, scented roses, the old roses.
Did you always have a very discriminating sense of smell?
No, I had to train it. This was kind
so
of
so you
my...
can you can learn this.
Oh yeah, yeah. I always paid attention. My mom had a very sharp nose, and so I always paid attention. But as far as, you know, perfumery and that, it was a matter of training, very specific, getting examples of aromatics and making sure that they came from a reliable source, so that I had rose from Bulgaria, which is different than rose from Turkey. And you can't just go somewhere and say, you know, I want rose and know exactly what you're getting. So it was a matter of very carefully sourcing different kinds of lavender. Lavender aroma changes with elevation.
Huh.
And so getting all of those and then just spending the time and smelling them and describing them. And this is when I started writing, because I had to start writing down my perceptions and figuring out the words and figuring out how to recall it and explain it. And then I started teaching as well. And it's always been interesting to talk to people about fragrance and how they perceive it, because it's very different for everybody.
It really is very different for everybody. And one of the things I learned from your book too is the importance of geography and terroir. In regards to even the same kind of fragrance, or the same source, the same tree or the same wood smells completely differently or has different notes depending upon where it comes from.
Exactly. And as I said, roses, even if it's the Rosa damascena, are different depending on where they grow. lavender, it really exhibits terroir in terms of elevation. It gets sharper and a little more, sharp with elevation. Different, you know, like black pepper, there is a geographical indicator of pepper in Kampot, you know, because it grows in a different soil. And so, and years make a difference. Natural perfumers run into this when they make a perfume 1 year and source the ingredients, and the next year they're a little bit different. And like wine, that's a beautiful thing.
Right.
You have to be able to explain it to the people who are buying your perfumes, and you know, your audience is going to be those people who understand that.
Now, what ties all these aromatics together is the chemistry, which you do a great job talking about and explaining in the book. Let's talk about aromatic chemicals. What are they?
They are the way that plants can communicate.
To each other?
To each other, to pollinators, to predators. They don't have teeth. They don't have claws unless, I guess, roses count. They can't move, and so they rely on scent as an intermediary to attract pollinators, for example.
But plants can't smell. They're detecting the chemicals, maybe.
Well, it depends. I guess I would say it depends on how you
define smell.
Yeah.
So they're sensing the chemicals, but they're not probably experiencing it the same way that we do.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Because they do, when you mow your lawn, you know that green.
Oh yeah, I love that smell. I love that smell.
So many people do. Well, the plant, the grass, is basically saying, "Help, help, I'm being eaten."
So you're smelling the dying cries of all these small blades of grass. That really puts a whole new slant on it. Oh my God. Holy smokes.
And it's okay. Because, you know, you got to do it, and grass can grow back.
Yeah, but now I feel bad.
Well, then let your grass grow.
That's right. That's a good way to talk about it. It's amazing reading your book, how old the human interest in fragrance is. It's absolutely incredible. It's almost it goes back to the very beginning of humankind in history.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, we're just going to talk. There's so much information in this book. I want to talk just about one group, and that's incense, wood, and resins. Is resin another word for sap?
No, it's not. And I thought it was. But the resin is produced actually in different structures in the plant. And often it is right there near the surface where it can ooze out and protect. A lot of the job of resins are to protect the plant from heat, from dryness, from the little bark beetles that come and eat all of our pine trees.
So again, it's a reaction against disturbance.
Yes, against predators or disease. It's protective.
Let's talk about two that I'm sure everybody's heard of and most people know nothing about. Frankincense and myrrh. What is the origin of these two resins?
They come from two different plants, but related, in the Arabian Peninsula and the Horn of Africa. So kind of across that, and I'm not going to remember my geography, that body of water there that separates them. And down on the very southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, some of the very best frankincense grows, and it grows on the limestone rocks. It does best in dry, rocky habitat, and the trees are fairly small. And the way you get the frankincense is actually to go out and wound the trees. You cut little scarifications into the trees, and they ooze this sap that forms into little droplets or tears.
They're called tears. I found that.
They're called tears.
It's so appropriate because you're wounding the tree.
I know. Again, as you said, I feel kind of bad when I use frankincense. But
the idea is to wound it, but to not kill the tree, right?
Exactly. And okay. That's what I was just going to say. Traditionally, it's been the traditional practice to know how much to wound the tree, how much to collect, and how to protect those trees because they're an extremely valuable resource.
One of the things I got from your book, too, is that these trees, these torchwoods, grow in such a particular geographical location that they have to be able to get the mists that come in off the ocean, yet it's still a fairly dry location. And in several cases, the sources for these resins are endangered now. People have used them so much over the years that there's not that much of them left.
That's part of the story. And it varies, I'm sure, from place to place. You know, the Horn of Africa also produces a lot of frankincense in addition to for the incense that's used in the Catholic Church.
Right.
Part of it is that actual practice of collecting the resin, but part of it is also conversion of the land to grazing or fire or disturbance or climate change. You know, there's this perilous and sort of magical balance between, you know, harshness of the environment and the ability of these plants to grow. And in many cases, they're kind of an umbrella plant for the ecosystem.
And they seem to be balanced so precariously that the slightest climate change is going to have a detrimental effect. Has there been attempts to try to sustainably sort of grow and then harvest these plants?
Yes. And I really am interested in learning more about that. I know there's been work in the Horn of Africa with the native local people in terms of harvesting and keeping the profits. Many of the essential oil products are gathered by local people who, you know, own the trees or travel to the trees. But there's a chain of supply that often a lot of the money doesn't come back to those locals.
Got it.
And so there's some efforts, and I'm really ready now that the book is done, and I'm, you know, to reach out to some of these efforts and start maybe, you know, doing some blogging and some more information about that.
Now, when these resins are collected, they therefore harden and form these little sort of, they almost look like jelly things, but they're not. They're hard. Now, they then are burned?
They are.
Now, talk to me about the fragrance of frankincense. What's it like? I know I've never smelt it before.
Yeah, it's the descriptor, you know, commonly used is resinous. So if you think of a pine tree, you've probably put your hand on a pine tree, but sharper and kind of purer to me. Many of them have kind of a citrus fragrance. So that little bit of a, you know, a nice orange or lemon, but a little bit. And I say in the book, you have to, this is where your nose has to start discriminating and say, okay, there's resin, but I need to get beyond the resin and smell those other little aspects.
Do you have a special process for correctly smelling something? Like, are you putting your nose just in something, or are you covering it up? What are you doing to get the correct notes?
The best way, and if you're burning incense, you know that's one thing.
Yep.
But the best way for me with perfume materials, which come mostly as essential oils, almost all of them benefit from being diluted, and you have to dilute them in pure ethanol or nearly pure. And what that does is open up and kind of separate those molecules so that your nose isn't overwhelmed. It's really easy for your nose to get overwhelmed. And so allowing them to open up like that with the alcohol. And then I'll put it on one of those little fragrance strips that you see at the mall.
Yep.
Or lay them out on my desk and walk away for a while and come back in and they kind of fill the room.
Yeah.
And that gives you a little bit different feel. And it's totally different if I take it outside. And then it's like, oh. So experiencing the fragrances in different kind of settings and making sure you open it up. And then sometimes I'll just stick my nose over the jar and take a big sniff.
Now, I think it's for frankincense. You said that your favorite was the Madi.
Madi. And I like that because that light, citrusy, sunshiny feeling comes through on that one.
Now, how would you describe the fragrance of myrrh?
That is so hard.
Is it harsh?
It can be, but a really beautiful myrrh is smooth. Okay. And it's kind of medicinal.
Huh.
You could probably describe it as resinous, but it's a totally different resin than what you would think of. Really deeply hidden underneath kind of the medicinal and smooth is a little tiny bit of sweetness. And it's just really interesting.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Elise Vernon Perlstein. And she's had a 17-year career in wildlife biology, which has prepared her for a second career as a natural perfumer, consultant, and educator on the biology, artistry, and history of perfume ingredients. And she's gotten some of her knowledge down in a wonderful book called Scent, A Natural History of Fragrance. Now, I love reading some of your descriptions of fragrances in this book because you don't pull punches. Agar wood, which comes from Asia, and I think it's also known as oud, O-U-D.
Yes.
You said it's not easy to love.
It's not.
Okay.
And it's very popular. If you're a perfumista, oud is kind of the big thing. But it's.
Wait a minute. Well, if it's not easy to love, why is it a big thing for perfumers?
If you use it correctly in a perfume, it really adds a lot of depth and interest. There are some very different types.
Okay.
It's very expensive, and so there are some synthetic replacements for it. It's endangered. It takes a long time for the tree to make the resin within the wood that is the fragrant part. The wood itself doesn't smell. But when the tree is injured, something in a small percentage of the trees triggers this production of a very dark resin that's very aromatic. It can be a little bit like a barnyard. It can be a little bit.
You said that in the book, and I was like,
I did.
Not as a person who lives in a farm. I know that some people love that smell. But a lot of people aren't that fond of it. I guess it's depending on what you raise. A pig farm would not be a good thing.
Well,
see, that made me immediately skeptical. That made me immediately skeptical when I read that in the book. I'm going, I don't know, I'll pass.
Yeah, maybe not a pig farm, but you know,
some
well-used straw at the bottom of a horse corral or something.
Okay.
And I'll probably, you know, there are very, very, very different smells.
Wow.
Of agar wood. Some of them have a berry-like hint.
Wow.
The kind of central theme, if you've got a nice one, is what you might call precious wood.
Mm-hmm.
Just a beautiful woody fragrance, but with these interesting urinous or fecal or, you know, dirty, sexy, whatever. And maybe that's
you're covering a lot of ground there.
I know.
One of the things I love about this book is that you talk a lot about the anthropology of these, and there were actual incense roads, pathways that people used to trade. Talk about those.
Well, they started, as I said, down at the southern tip of the Arabian Peninsula, where the best frankincense grows. And one of the nice things about these little tiers are that they're transportable.
And, you know, and they don't lose any of their effect?
Put them in a bag.
They don't lose any of
their... Well, they do after a while.
Okay.
But you could, you know, for a year, if you treat them carefully and put them in a nice, I don't know, canvas or leather bag, they keep their fragrance. Sandalwood would
wow.
do the same thing,
wow.
or agar wood. And that makes them, and this is my sort of rethinking history, that makes them something that can be used as a trade good. Now, way back, you talked about early in human history, one of the things that people associated with scent was that if it was a pleasant smell, it was good. And if you could burn that incense and see it rising up to the heavens, maybe that good smell was in the smoke and carrying messages.
Got it.
So these became, you know, very important components of religion and ritual.
Like,
and therefore
like,
were actively traded.
Like their use in censors.
Yes, exactly.
One of the other things you talked about, and it's funny because I taught art for many years, and I used to see Egyptian paintings with people with these weird cones on their head.
Mm-hmm.
And that was resins that they were burning on top of their head? Or they're melting?
It was most likely fat with aromatics, and they would put cinnamon and spices and
wow.
resins and leaves and flowers in these fats, and they had whole recipes for formulating.
Wow.
And then the interpretation is that, you know, sometimes they would just put those cones on their head, and as they dripped and melted, they smelled good.
Now, there are new world resins, and you talk about copal or copal. But what about,
uh-huh.
you talk about cannabis as being a resin too. And it does. It is.
That,
it definitely has resin in it.
Oh, yeah. The flowers are the part that we people, I say we, I mean generally people, use for the psychotropic
yep,
or the
yep.
beneficial effects. And that's in the resin, and it's in the female flowers.
I have to mention agar wood before we go and sandalwood. From Asia, China to New Guinea is agar wood. There are so many interesting stories in your book about this, about the Penan men of Borneo and how they harvest agar wood resins. It's
mm-hmm.
this whole ritual of them dressing up in black and sneaking out into the forest. It's amazing.
It was a lovely, it was a scholarly article, and I looked around and, you know, I really tried to find two or three sources for everything I talk about, and they do. It's just because there are so few of the trees, maybe 10% that actually produce the resin, it's a very treasured commodity.
Wow.
And there's this traditional knowledge among some of the people of kind of looking for particular signs. Maybe it's, and I couldn't find too much about this, but one of the papers I read said that cicadas, and I have no clue if it was a real cicada, are associated with it. And so they would listen for this call, but maybe it was a little beetle that injures the wood because it's that injury of the wood that stimulates the production of the actual agar wood. And, you know, they would find the places where they're maybe a little more stressed and therefore more
wow.
prone to have to protect themselves. And so this traditional knowledge was kind of encapsulated in the story of the Penan Benali.
Wow. There's so many fascinating rituals
anyway.
That you talk about in your book, and we're going to run out of time. We have minutes left. But there's a Japanese custom of kodo. Listening to incense, and it's an actual game that people played.
Yeah, yeah. And that, I must have, I spent a lot of time trying to distill that into a few pages. And essentially, it's very traditional. And back in, and I'm really bad with dates, but traditionally Japanese would sit around and they would evaluate the different instances. And maybe one would, the master of the ceremony kind of would pick one and pass it around and people would smell it. And you'd had to be very careful to hold it a certain way.
Wow.
And make sure you didn't breathe out so that you scattered the ashes. And then maybe there would be three different kinds and you would write down your guess. Or sometimes they would tell stories.
Wow.
And pick an incense that illustrated or supported that story. So there were a variety of different ways of listening to incense.
I love that. I just love that phrase. Listening to incense.
Yeah.
There's even legendary pieces of agar wood. There's the ren jatai or I don't know how it's pronounced, which was a gift from the Chinese to the Japanese emperor, and periodically they take off a tiny little slice of it.
It is hidden away in this museum.
Wow.
And it comes out on display every now and then, and it's supposedly the perfect fragrance. And if you want to, I guess, honor somebody greatly, you know, there have been times they have cut a little bit off. And I think I may be wrong, but I think they're little markers.
Right. You wrote about that. There's every piece that's been taken has a little marker written about what it was used for.
Yeah.
We've only scratched the beginning of this book. My guest tonight is Elise Vernon Perlstein. She had a 17-year career in wildlife biology, which has served her well in her second career as a natural perfumer, consultant, and educator on the biology, artistry, and history of perfume ingredients. And she's put some of that knowledge into this wonderful book, Scent, A Natural History of Fragrance. Elise, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed chatting with you. You asked some really good questions.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.